Today is Thursday. It's July 14th, 2022. This is a Grand Canyon Oral History with Ronnie McFarlane, R-O-N-N-I-E, last name spelled M-A-C-F-A-R-L-A-N-D.
I'll correct that.
Okay, thank you.
It's spelled M-C-F-A-R-L-A-N-D.
Okay, no Mac.
But I have been called Ronnie Mac, M-A-C, since the first grade. So pretty much everybody nationwide just knows me as Ronnie Mac.
Ronnie Mac. Okay. Do you go by Mac, or is it full together Ronnie Mac?
Just Ronnie Mac.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm going to call you from here on out then. My name is Tom Martin. Ronnie Mac, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, sir. You may.
Thank you. Ronnie, what year were you born?
I was born in 1959.
And do you know how your mom met your dad?
I have no idea.
Okay. All right. And where'd you grow up?
Well, I was born in Exeter, California, but my parents moved back to Oklahoma where my mom was raised at when I was just little, like two or three or so.
Okay.
So I've been raised in Gore, Oklahoma.
Okay.
Small town of about 325 people.
Wow.
32 miles kind of southeast of Muskogee.
Okay. What were your folks doing in California at the time? Do you know that?
Well, I think they had ventured out their way, or my mom's mom and dad had moved out there, I guess, for work, you know, in the 50s, I guess, or something.
Okay.
And my dad was in the military when he met my mom.
Okay. And then they headed back to Oklahoma from California.
My dad was raised up around Mountain Home, Arkansas.
Okay. Did you have any brothers and sisters?
I got three brothers.
Older, younger?
One older, two younger.
Okay. And did you go to school there in Gore?
Yep.
Okay.
Yes, I did.
Up through high school?
Yes.
What were your folks doing in Gore when you were growing up?
Well, my mom was just a homemaker while we was going to school, and then my dad was a construction carpenter.
Okay. So was he a journeyman? Was he traveling with that?
No, he didn't do any traveling. He just worked around home there.
Okay. All right. Growing up, did you guys, I'm assuming, you spent a lot of time outside walking the fields, or
had to work when I was, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. I mean, we had chores to do. I mean, my parents would plant a big garden, but it was up to me and my older brother to weed it and take care of it.
Okay.
We had chickens and cows and pigs and stuff, and I'd have to feed them.
Okay. Cows are a 7 day a week, 24 hour, you know, 365 day a year operation right there. How many did you have?
Oh, we never had too many when I was growing up. You know, maybe 15 or 20 until I got, you know, like up in high school. Then I started buying some cows.
Okay. That's 15 or 20.
Let me take that back. I got like a dollar a week allowance, and I would save my allowance up. And like in the summertime when I was out of school, I'd go buy bottle calves at the sale. Usually two or three calves, and then sack of milk replacer for like $4, I'd have to save my money up, you know, to buy a sack of feed, and then that would, you know, last three calves about a month. And then in the winter time, after I sold the calves, I'd usually buy some pigs or whatever and fatten them up, and then, you know, sell them to people for butcher calves, and then I'd take that money the next spring, and then I'd buy more calves.
Nice. Were you thinking then in high school that you might want to run either dairy cattle or run some sort of a ranch and farming thing?
Oh yeah, hell, all I ever wanted to be from the time I can remember was to be a cowboy.
Okay. And how did that work out?
Probably still was about as much a cowboy as anybody. I mean, I started mowing lawns in the summertime when I was like 10 or 11.
Okay.
For 75 cents an hour. And for where my mom and dad lived at, I had to push that mower up a pretty steep gravel road for about a quarter of a mile to get to the paved road, and then another three quarters of a mile. But once you got up to the paved road, there was a bunch of homes up there around Fin and Feather Resort that a lot of retired people lived in.
Okay.
And I'd just go up there and just go door to door, ask them if they need any yard work. Of course, some of them would say no, and some of them would say yes.
Nice.
That's kind of how the work ethic started.
Well, yeah, and it sounds like your folks were a big part of that.
It was more motive to start working to make the money that paid something.
Okay.
Versus having to work all day in the garden for free.
Got it. So you were raising dairy cows and pigs. Were you raising chickens as well?
Oh yeah, we had chickens.
How many?
Oh, probably 30.
Okay. So you had eggs to sell. You had chickens to sell.
We never really sold any chickens. I mean, we'd sell eggs. People would stop by and buy milk.
Okay.
People would stop by and buy butter.
All right, I was going to say, you're talking to a desert boy that knows like zero about dairy cattle, but when you say butter, I think churning.
Yes.
And how did...
I'll back up and explain how that works.
Thank you.
All cattle will have a certain amount of butter fat in their milk.
Yep.
Beef cattle, not near as much as dairy cattle, and different dairy breeds have different levels of butter fat.
Okay.
You know, so like a Jersey or a Guernsey have a lot more butter fat than what like a Holstein or a Brown Swiss or some of them like that will. So like all the bigger dairies, commercial type dairies nowadays, they like the Holstein cows because they produce the most milk.
Okay.
But anyway, we had one Guernsey cow and one Jersey cow.
Hmm.
Is what we milked.
Okay.
So I'd go out every morning when my dad would get up to get ready to go to work, and I'd go out, and I'd let each one of them cows had a calf. We kept it pinned separate from them, and I'd let the calf nurse on one side, and I'd milk the other side.
Hmm. All right.
So out of the two cows, I'd still end up with a gallon of milk on the milk at night.
Okay.
So then you bring that milk in, and we'd strain it through a cloth to get any dust or hay particles or whatever, because the cow's going to be switching her tail and whatever whenever you're doing all that.
Yeah, yeah.
We just put it in the refrigerator and let it set in about a day's time. All that butter fat will rise to the top.
Okay.
But you just reach down down in there with a ladle and you pull that butter fat off. We put it in another gallon jar when you got, half, three quarters of a jar of that butter fat. Well, then we would churn it. And my parents were real poor. The way we would churn it, you just set it out, let it get to room temperature, and you just have to shake it in that gallon jug, and then every couple of minutes you'd have to crack the lid to let the air bleed off, and the churning process, it would produce air.
Okay.
I guess it'd be like trapped inside the butter fat.
Yep.
And sometimes it would churn, in 15 or 20 minutes, and other times you might have to shake that thing for an hour to get it to churn.
Wow.
But then as it churned, I mean, the butter has the color of butter, but it would just be kind of clumped and grouped up together in wads, maybe the size of a tennis ball.
Okay.
Well, you dip them out and put it in a colander or strainer, and you just take a spoon and just squeeze the milk and the byproduct waste out of it. Then if you had a butter mold, you'd put it in a mold or however you want to do it, and just let it chill.
Okay.
In the fridge, and then, or you'd add some salt to it, and then voila, you had butter.
Nice. Okay. So,
I'll tell you another story on that.
Yeah, please.
I was probably 8 or 9, and we had drove over to Mount Home one weekend to visit my mom or my dad's family. His mom and uncles and our brothers and sisters and stuff like that. But on the way back, the way we would go, we'd go up to Stillwell, Oklahoma, then cut the back roads over toward Perry Grove into Fayetteville and then a series of other little towns to get up to Mountain Home. But always on the way back home on Sunday, there was an antique store at Stillwell, and we'd always stop and go over there and look around. And sometimes my parents would buy something. Most time we'd just look.
Mm-hmm.
But we was in there one day, and I seen this gallon jug up high on the shelf, and it had a wooden paddle in it and a hand crank. And I asked the guy that owned the store, he goes, "What is that?" He goes, "Well, that's a butter churn." I'm just okay, how much you want for it? He goes, $4. Well, I reached in my pocket and I had $4. I said, "I'm just going to buy that." And all the way home, all I heard out of my parents, "I can't believe you wasted $4 on that butter churn. We've been churning butter for years, just find the way we are." I'm like, "Yeah, we." So anyway, I bought it, and I put up with the ridiculing out of them. But anyway, the next time it was time to churn, I put it in that churn I bought, and within 10 minutes, we got butter. I'm done.
Nice.
And I was like, that was money well spent. So then a few months later, we make another one of those trips. We'd usually go about twice a year. We stopped in that same store again, and the guy had a butter mold. There ain't no telling how old this butter mold was, but it had the little dovetail notch corners. It was, handcrafted.
So this was a wooden mold.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
And I bought it for $1.
Okay.
It was a 1 pound mold.
So about the size of two fists?
Yeah, it was probably 2.5 inches wide, probably 2.5 inches tall, and about 4 inches long.
Okay. What had you been using?
Oh, they would just put it in a small bowl.
Okay.
And once it got hard, you just turn the bowl upside down and know, the butter was rigid enough that, you know, and then they just wrap it up in foil and, you know, leave it in the refrigerator.
Right. Okay. So now you had a mold.
Of course. Yeah, of course, I never got none of the milk or egg or butter money, but once they people started buying it out of that 1 pound mold, you know, then everybody wanted butter. And everybody would compliment about, you know, that is so neat, you know. I guess none of them had been around or had access to a butter mold.
Okay. So at this point now, are you looking to bring in more cows? If you've got more people asking for more butter and more milk.
No, I didn't want to get into any more cows. Not milking cows. I wanted to buy like beef cattle.
Okay. Where was the money to be made? Was the money to be made in beef cattle, or was it to be made in dairy?
No, it was. To me, it was more about the beef cattle.
Okay.
You know, I didn't have to milk them.
Right.
And they would raise the calf, and then I could sell the calf.
Okay.
So then, by the time I was about 11 or 12, I started working at a. There was a resort, Fin and Feather Resort, and they had, you know, cabins people would rent, and they raised all their own beef. And anyway, I would work, you know, mowing around the cabins and for them and help them pick up the trash and make the garbage run. And when they baled hay, you know, I would haul hay for them. And I did that up until I was about, I don't know, 15 and a half or so. And then I started working at the livestock auction. There was one at Telequa on Saturdays that I'd work at. And then in the summertime, I would work at Muskogee Stockyards and the same people on Pryor. So I'd work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday at Muskogee and Pryor. And then sometimes I'd work Thursday and Friday back at Muskogee, cleaning up and getting ready for the next sale, and then Saturday I'd work at the Telequa sale barn. And the minimum wage back then was like $1.60 an hour.
Hey, Ronnie.
Yeah.
At the Many Feather Resort.
No, it's Fin and Feather.
Sorry.
Fin and Feather Resort.
Fin and Feather.
Yep.
Got it. Were you working there just the summers, or were you trying to work there weekends during school? How was that all working out?
I'd usually work a couple hours after school and then on Saturdays.
Okay. And what were they paying you?
$2 an hour.
Whoa. That was better than the livestock auction work.
Yeah, but the livestock auction was a whole lot more fun.
Was it? Why?
Well, I just like being around cattle and the sale, and I just liked it better.
Okay, all right. Well, I'd imagine there'd be a lot more people there, and maybe a lot more action. Than the resort. So you were 13, 14. Did you actually do any auction work? Did you work as an auctioneer?
No, sir.
Okay.
I worked at about every position in a livestock auction except being the auctioneer.
Okay.
I've worked in the sale ring. I've run the scales weighing cattle after they were sold. I've worked on both sides, running them into the ring side and then working in the pinning alley on the pinning side after they sold. And, you know, checking them in when the farmers and ranchers would bring them in to sell and load them out on the semis when the sale was over. I mean, I've I've done everything there is to do at one except auction.
And how much would the auction company take? What kind of percentage for, you know, a rancher would come in with cattle or a farmer to come in with dairy cows?
Well, most of that hasn't changed a whole lot through the years. It was like 3% then, and most of them are like maybe 3.75% now.
Okay.
So even though the cattle today, you know, are bringing more money than they did in the early 70s, but the percentage hadn't really changed.
Right. Right. I mean, costs have all gone up for everybody everywhere. So, yeah.
But I mean, yeah, but the percentage is still going to be the same. I mean, if you got by on 3% of an animal that brought $150 in 1974,
right?
Well, then you can get by on 3% of an animal that brings $800 in 2022,
right?
And there's been a few auction barns that try to got greedy, raised their commission rates up, or people quit using them.
Yeah, I bet.
And then they wonder why. What happened to their business? That's why you just got greedy.
That's right. That's right. So, did you graduate from high school there in Gore?
Yes, I did.
What year was that?
1977.
Okay, so you were 18 years old?
Yep.
Okay. So some kids, when they grow up, their parents are like, when you go to college, and other kids, when they grow up, college is never talked about.
Well, my parents couldn't afford college.
But sometimes, you know, you can do a scholarship for football or, you know, athletic kind of stuff. Or were you, like, not even thinking about it?
I wasn't really even thinking about it. There was Gloyd Miller was the vet that worked in Muskogee Stockyards, and he tried and begged me to go to college, and he was going to sponsor me
Wow.
to be a large animal vet.
Wow.
And I'm just like, Lord, I don't like school that well. And I sure don't want to spend 12 years to become a vet when, like, right now I can be riding bulls, chasing girls, having fun.
Right.
And now that I'm older, I might wish I had reconsidered that offer, but that's still an awful lot of school.
It is.
Willing to go through to become a veterinarian.
But he must have seen something in you to offer to put you through school.
Well, and of course, I mean, I would help him test all the cows, like at Muskogee sale. And what you have to do is you have to run them through a head gate, see how old they are, draw a vial of blood out of them so we can test to make sure they didn't have what's called Bang's disease. And it was a big thing back in the 60s, early 70s. Then they come up with the calf hood vaccination that they started using in the late 70s, early 80s. And like now, it's pretty much a thing of the past.
How do you spell that disease?
Bangs, B-A-N-G-S.
Thank you.
It's got a long doctor type name, but it was just stupid. The common people just shortened it up to Bangs. I'd have to go back and do some research to find out this exactly what the medical. But anyway, but what the disease does, it makes a cow not carry a calf to full term. She will abort it when she's about 3 or 4 months along.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But anyway, I'd help Gloria do all that stuff, and I guess he liked my work ethic, and I wasn't scared to get shit thrown all over me, or, you know, get in a pen with a bunch of mean wild cattle and, you know, take care of them, so.
Nice. And when did you get into bull riding?
I started bull riding in about 1976.
There in Gore or in Muskogee?
California. It was a nearby town. David Bailey and his mom were co-owners in the Muskogee Stockyards in the prior livestock auction. But David was also a big-time rodeo stock contractor.
Okay.
So I knew him from working around the barns there. Well, and back then, you know, he'd buy any bull that he thought looked like it might buck. So he'd gather them bulls up, and on Sunday, we'd go to the arena there, telephone, and he'd buck them, and that's how I got started riding. I'd get on them green bulls and see what they'd do.
Hmm. What was the pay for that?
Oh, you did it for free.
Okay. It sounds like a good way to make a fast trip to the ground.
You know, when I first started rodeoing, I mean, going to the pro rodeos, competing with the big guys, I did real good my first 2 years. Never got hurt or nothing. And then in October of 78, I was iron working, but I still rodeoed on the weekends. And I'd entered a rodeo there in Muskogee. They used to have every, like the end of October, 1st of November, called the Okie 100 Bull Ride. And that was the early stage set for what's like the PBR nowadays.
Okay.
But that was like the biggest bull riding that they'd ever put on at the time.
Hmm.
Anyway, I had entered that, and I drew a bull that I'd had before, and I knew I could win on him. Well, I nod my head, and the bull comes out there about 2 or 3 real high jumps, kind of like a bucking horse would do, and then he just turned back to the left and went to spinning. And I made a qualified ride, and I was a little cocky, a little big for my britches. And I had this habit of, when the buzzer would ring, I would stay on the bull for like an extra second or so, and I'd kind of get in time with him, and I would like slide back on his hindquarters, and as he bucked up, it would like throw me out there and make like a flying dismount.
So you could do a like a somersault and land on your feet.
Well, I wouldn't do a somersault, but I would just stay vertical when I'd land on my feet.
Okay.
Most of the time. This particular night, I miscalculated slightly. Instead of landing on my feet, I landed on my side.
Oop.
Well, I go to roll over to get up, and the bull, his head is right against my head. He just shoves me down. Well, his whole body is still up in the air. When his front foot comes down, it lands on my left knee.
Oops.
And he hits and turns what goes on. And I mean, it broke above him, the bone above and below the knee, right there in the knee joint.
Wow. So that's your femur and your tibia.
Yeah.
The big bone above and the big bone below.
Anyway, I ended up having to have it operated on.
I bet.
And that had me sidelined for a couple of months.
Let's back up a minute, because you mentioned that by this time, and this is in 1978.
Yep.
So you're 28 now, 29.
No, not.
Wait, 60. I'm sorry.
I'm like 19.
I'm messing up here. You're more 59, 60, 70. Okay, that's right. I'm goofing up here. Badly. Okay, 19. But you already mentioned you'd done a little bit of iron working.
I started iron working June the 6th, 1977.
How did you start that job? How did that come about?
Well, there was a guy that lived there in Gore, Slim Henderson. And I went to school with his daughters. He had one daughter that was a grade ahead of me, Terry, and she's actually my banker to this day.
Okay.
He had a daughter a grade below me, Christy. Well, I mean, I knew him my whole life. And I'd hauled some hay for him, and he asked me what I was going to do after I got out of high school. And I said, oh, I don't know. I'd kind of like to go maybe get into construction or something. I said, but I don't want to be a carpenter or a cement finisher. I said, I'd rather do something different. He got to show me some pictures because he's a union iron worker.
Ah.
So he had me go up to the union hall in Tulsa, local 584. And I tried to get an apprenticeship program up there. But at that particular time, the business agent was Kenneth Halpain. Well, Kenneth Halpain lived in Hulbert, Oklahoma, which is a little old small town west of Tahlequah. And about everybody that lives in Hulbert is a union iron worker, and most of them are tower hands, work on communication towers and stuff like that.
Okay.
Well, if you wasn't kin to Halpain or live in Hulbert, he wasn't going to let you in local 584.
Hmm.
And I tried 3 or 4 weeks, you know, I'd drive up there and try to get in, and he wouldn't even talk to me. And, I stopped by Slim's house there one weekend, and he asked me how it was going. I said, well, I've been up there. You know, I'm trying to get in the apprenticeship program. I said, but he won't even talk to me. And Slim was out of local 48 there in Oklahoma City.
Okay.
He's like, come up to the city Monday. Hubert Hornbeck was the business agent at the time. He goes, I bet you we can get you in up there.
Hmm.
So I drive up there Monday morning. You know, green high school kid, you know, don't know woe from sickum. I walk in there and introduce myself to him. He's like, Slim says you want to be an iron worker. So, well, I'd like to try it. I don't know whether I'd be any good at it. I said, but I'd like to give it a try. He goes, well, let me think about it. He goes, I'll be in touch. I said, okay. So I leave the union hall, and that was on a Monday, so I drive over by Oklahoma National Stockyards, which is the biggest livestock auction in the world now, just to watch the cattle sell for, you know, a couple hours or so. Then I drive back to Gore. Back then, you know, the speed limit was like 55 because of the Jimmy Carter year, so it would take you 4 hours to make that 200-mile trip.
Okay.
Anyway, I get back home, and by the time I got back to my mom and dad's house, Hubert had called. Told me, come on up. So I drove back up there the next morning, and he gets me all signed up in the union, and I had to pay, I forget, $175 or something to, get started in the program. He gave me a list of tools that I need to go get, so I went. Little contractor supply about a quarter of a mile from the Union Hall. I got me everything that was on that list. I come back to the hall, and he looks my belt over. He's like, well, you're going to stand out like a sore thumb with all them new tools. I said, well, I'm going to stand out anyway because got to start somewhere. So anyway, he sends me out to a job.
Hey, Ronnie Mac, hang on a second here. I'm curious to know, what do you remember was on that list of things to get?
Well, a 25-foot tape measure.
Okay.
A 12-inch crescent wrench.
Okay.
A 7/8 spud wrench and a 3/4 spud wrench.
So
that was for the size of bolts they were for. The job is 1 7/16 for a 7/8 and 1 1/4 for a 3/4 bolt.
For a spud wrench, does that have a wrench on one end and goes down to a tapered point on the other, or what is a spud wrench?
Yeah, that is it.
Okay.
Two bull pins, two bolt bags, a tool belt, and a 6-pound beater, sledgehammer.
Okay.
We call
them
beaters, ironworking business.
All right. And a belt to hook all that stuff on.
Yep.
Hard hat? Was that part of the deal, or was that?
Yeah, I had to get a hard hat too, but that was it. I mean, there was no safety harnesses back then, no safety glass issues. I mean, they'd give you goggles or a face shield if you're just going to be grinding or chipping, but for just normal work.
Did they sell you a pair of gloves?
Negative.
Okay.
The only time I wear gloves even to this day is in the wintertime when it gets so cold I have to.
Yeah, okay. All right.
And a lot of companies are trying to make it mandatory where you have to have gloves to cut down on hand injuries. But me being in supervision, I don't wear them unless I need them.
Right. Okay. All right. So you got all this stuff and it's all shiny new. And that, I'm thinking that outlay right there might have been close to $100. What do you get for that? More maybe?
It was like $87 for everything back then. If you had to do it now, you'd probably spend $300 or $400. But
well, you've got about $250 in the game now. This is getting expensive.
Well, and I was a first period apprentice, so the pay for a first period apprentice in 1977 was $4.05 an hour.
Okay.
And I thought, damn, I'll never see another 4 day. Anyway, so he sends me out to this job. And they're doing precast. It's a tilt-up job. They're using precast panels, but they're making a Voltex school with it. Of course, I mean, I don't know nothing. And the guy there sending me back and forth here and there. Anyway, I worked there for probably, 2 months. And we were about finished, and the guy running the job, he's like, would you be interested in going? The company had several jobs around the city. He said, would you be interested in going over toward Yukon? They had a little addition on the power plant. I said, no, I don't care. I'll go over there. So I went to that other job there on that power plant, and really the first structural steel I'd been around. And I'm watching the guys, and they can climb the columns and walk the beams, and I'm like, that's pretty cool. But they had me on the ground. I'd go get bolts for guys and tie them to a rope, and then pull them up. And, you know, I'd stack up four bys after the raising gang to set beams. And just for about 2 weeks, I just did grunt work. And then they needed some help bolting up, so then I went up on the iron and started bolting up. And I did that for probably 6 months or so, and we finished that job.
Okay, hang on a second. My questions are building up here. So I'm
giving you more history about me. We should be talking about the bridge.
We're getting there. We're getting there. The Navajo Bridge is coming, but how you got to get there is important. What's a first period apprentice?
Well, you got like, back then, they had like four levels of apprenticeship.
Okay.
So like the first 6 months, you're like a first period apprentice, which is what I kind of refer to as, you know, just a green or a virgin apprentice. You don't know nothing. You're there to learn.
Yep.
And then you go to second period apprentice, and then third, and then fourth. And nowadays, they've got it where there's like 8 periods to it. And I argued all the time. I said, well, we had better hands when the apprenticeship program was only 4 periods, and you could get through it in 2 years.
Okay.
Nowadays, you drag it out over 4 years, and the guys that want to learn are going to learn everything they need to know to be a journeyman in 2.
Right.
And the ones that take 4 years, they're just as dumb after 4 years as they were the day they started.
Fair enough. Okay, so that kind of makes sense then. In that time frame you mentioned, going up on the iron to bolt up, you got up there pretty fast. You were still in your first 6 months. And can you then describe for me bolting up? What does that entail?
Well, what bolting up entails is when the raising gang, which that's the crew that hangs the iron, what they'll do is they'll put it in place. They'll put 2 to 4 to 6 bolts, depending on how heavy the piece is. Let's just say they put 2 bolts in each end, and they cut loose and just keep hanging. Well, the bolt up crew comes behind them and puts all the bolts in.
Which might be how many per joint? I'm thinking...
Well, I mean, it can be anywhere from 4 bolts to 50 bolts, depending on the iron.
Okay.
And how big it was.
Right. And these are going to be half-inch diameter bolts, roughly?
Yeah, most of the time they were like, they're either going to be 3/4 diameter, 7/8 diameter, or 1 inch diameter.
Okay. And in theory, you'd have to be careful not to drop those things, because somebody down on the ground wouldn't have a good day if that happened.
Well, I mean, you didn't want to drop anything, because then you had to go back down and get it.
Okay.
You sure didn't want to drop any of your tools.
Right. And so one of the things that would have been going on up there was, I'm assuming, there wasn't a lot of safety. But again, that's an assumption on my part, which may be very wrong, as far as safety belts are concerned, that kind of stuff.
Oh, no, this is all back before all this safety came to be. There was no safety.
Okay.
Your safety was common sense. And knowing that if you messed up, you're just going to fall and die. Okay. Was your safety opinion.
All right. And I'm putting this back to your knee. How did that knee heal up for you?
It healed up okay.
All right.
Of course, it was pretty tender for like the first 6 months, but it healed up all right.
Okay, because I'm thinking you need your balance and agility. Now, you've got that. I mean, you're riding bulls, and you've worked out a fun dismount. So you've got, you know, you're pretty agile. I think that would come in handy.
Yeah, when I first broke it and they operated on it, the doctor said, well, you're probably going to have a limp the rest of your life.
Hmm.
And I think a lot of that was a mental deal. But I refused to limp. I mean, I didn't have a choice, you know, when they first took the cast off. But I would force myself to walk where I wouldn't limp.
Okay.
Just to prove a problem.
Yeah. Good. And this was a, this when you got to your first bolt up job, that's in Utah?
No. I was still in Oklahoma City.
Oh, I thought that was on the power plant. I got confused.
No, it was, but it was there west of Oklahoma City.
Oh, okay. I don't know how I got Utah wrapped up in this.
We'll get to Utah later on.
Okay.
It ain't time for Utah yet.
All right. So how high did you go on that first bolt up job?
250 feet. That was as tall as a boiler was.
That's a world away. That's a long ways up there.
And they was up probably 50 feet when I started.
Okay.
So, the first 3 or 4 days up on the iron, you could tell I was green. But it didn't take me long to adjust to it.
Okay. So I'm thinking the bolt-up crew is going to put in, as you say, 4 to 6 bolts. Would everything line up easily, or would you have to really work at it to get your bolts?
You'd have to work at it. That's what you needed the two bullpens for.
Okay.
And a bullpen is just like the end of a spud. It starts out about, you know, 7/8 diameter at the big end and down to nothing, and it'll be 8 inches long. Well, you stick it down in there and get it started in the hole and drive it in there with your beater.
Right.
Line the hose up to where you can get the bolts in.
And then you'd have to knock that out, and you'd have one hole left, and you'd bolt it up, and you're moving on.
Yep.
Okay. Did you have air hammers for this, or were you doing this all manual?
No, I mean, when we just bolted up, we just do it manually.
Okay.
Just snug them up, then we would come back once we had everything plumbed up, and then tighten the bolts with an air impact.
Okay. All right, and then plumbing up, that must have been, I mean, a 25-foot tape, I'm thinking that might have been a bit short for something like that, but it might have worked, I don't know.
The tape measure would just be like, if you had to measure a piece of decking to cut it to fit around the column, or
okay,
five centers of beams, you know, to mark centers to rig them up where they come up level, you know. Tape is just for that, measuring bolts. Make sure you got the right size bolts.
Okay. And then how would you've got this structure 200 feet high, 250 feet high in the air. How would you plumb that up as you went?
Well, we plumb it up. It's in tiers.
Okay.
So say your columns are 50 feet long.
Okay.
Well, you'd hang that first 50 feet, and then you'd put steel cables from column to column, making an X.
Okay.
And you'd have a turnbuckle on each end of it down at the bottom, and you could get up on one or whatever.
Yep.
To pull it to where it was plumb.
Okay.
And you set up a transit to look in through there to make sure the building was plumb, and then once you got it plumb, then you go up there and tighten the bolts, and then grout the bottom of the base plates, and then you'd hang the next tier, do the same thing. Once it was tied in, you'd hang your plumb cables, get it plumbed up, and tighten all the bolts, and just keep jumping up as you went up.
Okay. So you mentioned grouting. I'm assuming once you plumb things up, there might be a gap somewhere.
Well, you set all those columns on shim packs.
Okay.
So say they pour the footer and they got anchor bolts cast in the concrete.
This is at the ground.
Yes.
Yep.
And every structural engineer of record, he'll have his own preference.
Okay.
And back then, most of the time, they wanted like at least an inch of grout.
Okay.
Nowadays, most of them want 3 to 4 inches of grout for Ooh. Whatever reason. I don't know.
Okay.
But it's their stamp and their seal on it, so you got to give them what they ask for.
Okay.
So you'd put shim packs down there on top of the concrete for your column to set on. The shim packs would hold the column to the right elevation.
Okay.
And then they would grout just so when the building was loaded, you had equal pressure pushing down on the footer.
Makes sense. Okay.
Or otherwise, if you just had the shim pack, you'd be point loading the footer.
Right.
Under stream conditions, it could bust the footer out.
Right. So if the steel was just sitting on the shim packs, it wouldn't be loading the footer completely.
Evenly,
right. It would be point loading it. Okay. All right. And how long were you on that job?
Oh, probably about 6 months.
Okay. And that was in Oklahoma?
Yes.
Okay. 250 feet, that's up there a ways.
And then I left that power plant and went to work at a power plant at Sholto, Oklahoma, which was actually out of local 584's jurisdiction.
Okay. And what happened?
They were needing help. But they were needing help, and they had called our hall there in Oklahoma City.
Oh, okay.
Asking if we had anybody available. And I don't know, there was probably 20 of us went over there and went to work on that.
All right.
And I remember walking into that Tulsa hall to clear in, and there's that Kenneth Halfay, and he's just like, "What are you doing here?" And I'm here to take one of them calls for that powerhouse there at Sholto. He's like, "Didn't you try to get in the program?" I said, "I did, and you didn't give me the time of day." So I went to Oklahoma City and got in the program up there.
Were you still in your apprenticeship at that time?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So were you in level 3 by then?
Yes.
Okay. And what did he say?
He just handed me the referral, and I went out there and went to work.
Nice. Nice. Very good.
And I was hooking on in the racing gang, and that's the guy that puts the chokers on the beams and hooks them to the crane for the crane to hoist them up there and put them into place.
Okay, so you're not bolting anymore. Now you're hooking on. So the steel comes in, I'm assuming, on a semi.
Yes.
And then does it get, like, forklifted off the ground?
Well, we do it nowadays, but back then we just unloaded with the crane. We'd have to take bigger chokers,
yep.
And we'd choke around a bundle of beams. They might be, you know, anywhere from 3 to, you know, a dozen beams, depending on how heavy they were. We'd just put big chokers around it, pick them up, swing them off to the side, land them on 4x. Once we got the truck unloaded, we'd take our street hooks off that we used to unload it with, and we put what's called shakeout hooks on there, and they just got a hook on the end that comes to a point that you can stick in the bolt holes or test the top flange of the beams to roll them all up workways.
Okay. So those are called shakeout hooks. So hang on a second. Let me make sure I figure this out. Because there's a at the bottom of the first Navajo bridge on the slope on the Fredonia side, there's a chain, and that chain has two of these hooks on the end of each end of that chain and a ring in the middle. And so is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Similar. I'll have to round up a picture of a shakeout hook, or I'll take one tomorrow at work and then send it to you.
Okay, thank you. And so you've got this hook that comes to a point, like you say, you can get it through a bolt hole, and then would it be on a steel cable that would go to a similar thing on the other end? Or would it go to a loop?
It would be the hook would be attached to a steel cable, and in the those hooks, I mean, they could be anywhere from 20 to 40 feet long, and they would hook up to the ball on the crane.
Okay.
And he would lift them up and get them turned up workways, and then we'd set them back down to where we could come back when we're ready to hang it, put chokers around it in the center to hoist it up into place.
Okay, so would you have a low crane, like a yard crane, and then you'd have a...
No, back then we just used the crane we was hanging iron with.
Okay. And was hooking on a step up from the bolting crew?
Well, to me it was.
Okay.
A lot of guys, kind of pride themselves in being in the racing game, because that's like the elite of the elite if you're in the racing game.
Okay.
Bolt up crew is like the next level down. So if you put it in the military terms, the racing gang would be like the Marine Corps.
Okay.
Then the bolt-up crew would be like the Army.
Okay.
And then the decking and detail crew would be kind of like the Air Force. I mean, just...
Mm-hmm. Just working that analogy. Yeah.
Yeah.
So hooking up, were you still making $4 an hour, or had that price gone up a bit?
By that time, I was up to, I want to say, right around $8.
Whoa. Okay.
The scale at that time was like $9.75. So I was making, about $1.50, $1.75 less than journeyman pay.
Okay.
And I had hooked on for probably a month on that job, and we come into work one Monday morning, and we had three connectors that would work up in the air hanging the iron. Well, all three of the connectors didn't show up.
Okay, so now here's a new term that I don't know what that means. What's a connector?
A connector is the guy that climbs the column, grabs the beam when the crane hoists it up there, gets it into place, spuds a hole, gets the bolt, two bolts in it to where they can cut loose from the crane.
Okay. All right.
So anyway, the three connectors didn't show up, so Wayne Johnson was pushing the racing gang. He was the foreman, and he asked me and another guy, Kenny Lee Runyon, who was an apprentice also, if we'd go up and connect.
Okay. Had you guys done that before?
No, neither one of us had.
Okay.
And we both told him, so, well, we'll give it a try, but we've never connected before. We just want you to know that before you start yelling and raising hell with us. Cause
fair enough.
Ass tubes were free back then, and you got them off it.
Yep, okay.
But they make good iron workers out of you.
Yes, sir.
So anyway, me and Kenny, we go up there, and we start hanging iron.
Had you worked with Kenny before?
No, that was the first time me and Kenny worked together.
Okay.
So both of us had never connected before, but we got through that day, and our peace count was only about 10 off of what the other guys done, and I thought that was pretty good.
Wow.
For two greenhorns.
And what did Wayne think?
He thought we did all right.
Okay.
But he wouldn't sugarcoat nothing. He said, y'all still got a lot to learn, but at least you tried. He goes, that's
nice.
That's all I can for.
Fair enough.
So we show up the next day. The racing gang ain't there again. So we go up and connect. Well, that particular day, our piece count was higher than the main racing gang.
Oops.
So we show up the third day. Well, the racing gang shows up. I'm like, well, here we go. We're either going to be back at the bulked up crew or back cooking on or whatever. Everybody's around the gang box. And of course, the guys that missed 2 days of work, you know, they're like, you know, kind of got their head tucked between their legs, you know, knowing that they screwed up. And Wayne comes over and he's like, y'all can gather y'all shit and hit the road. Well, who's going to hang your iron? Wayne looks at me and Kenny goes, them two boys right there have been hanging the last 2 days and their piece count's higher than y'all's. Because I'd rather have them. At least they show up every day and they'll listen when I tell them something.
Nice.
So those guys got mad and they got all but hurt.
Yep.
Some of them wanted to fight. But we went up there, and went back to hanging iron. And when we got that building set out, I went back to Oklahoma City, and Beasley was doing what was called a seed house.
Okay, hang on a second. So, tell me about Beasley. This is B-E-A-S-L-E-Y?
Yes.
And who are they and what did they do? Because I think they're going to play a big role in the future here of this history.
Oh, yeah. That company was founded in like the early 40s. I want to say like 1941 by John F. Beasley.
Okay.
In Muskogee, Oklahoma. That's where they started.
Okay.
And how he got his start in the steel erection was he was just like a general contractor, and he had built three cotton gins in Weber Falls, which was right across the river from Gore, where I was raised at.
Okay.
Well, they had a flood in 42. And it washed about half of the bridge out that carried Highway 64 from Gore over to Weber that went on to Warner and Shakota and Muskogee and then points west. This is back before any interstates, you know.
Right.
But anyway, somewhere or another, John talked him into letting him build the bridge back.
Okay.
And that's how he got in the steel erection business.
In bridges? Or was he doing structures and towers and the whole deal, or was he just bridges?
He did everything.
Okay.
At one time, even up into the mid-60s, he was the largest independently owned construction company in the United States.
Wow. Wow. Did you get a chance to meet John?
Yes, I did.
What do you remember about him?
He was a no-nonsense, direct, to the point. But if he liked you, he liked you.
Okay.
If he didn't like you, you knew it.
Okay.
The first time I met him, this is going to go a little bit later on down the anyway, I went back to Oklahoma City, and Beasley was doing this seed house, which is just a metal structure, super large barn that they store grain in.
Okay.
Well, and I had heard of Beasley, but and they had kind of a bad rap, and everybody called them the killer bees.
Oh, wow.
Well,
that doesn't bode well.
But most of the people that started those rumors had never worked for them because they wasn't worth the shit and they wouldn't last anyway.
Okay, fair enough.
But anyway, I said, I'll go out there and work for them. I ain't scared. So I go out there, and Virgil Rath was the guy running the job. And I introduced myself to him. And he takes me over there and introduces me to Rick Peters, which is Bob Peters' boy. And Bob worked on the bridge down in Panama.
Okay, so this is the Bridge of the Americas over the Panama Canal.
Yes, so Rick's dad, Bob, worked on that bridge. So that's how I met Rick.
Okay, and that bridge over the Americas is where Ed Kent and his brother Lamar worked.
Yes, and Bob was down there with them.
Okay, all right. So this is we're starting to lay out the connections here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Starting to build the roadmap.
Very good. So Ronnie Mac, we have been yik-yakking now quite happily for a little over an hour. And this might be
we ain't even scratched the surface yet. We ain't even got to the good stuff.
I'm telling you, I'm thrilled. I am thrilled. This sounds like your introduction to Beasley sounds like a good place to put a comma in this oral history series.
Okay.
Because I'm going to want to know all about that job there. I'm putting up that super large barn for Beasley. And you mentioned Rick Peters. So this just sounds like a good place to, like I say, put a comma here. Thinking about what we've just talked about already, is there anything else in that ground that we've covered that you want to add that I didn't ask or you were thinking about that should go in there?
Well, I don't think so. I think we've
okay.
I like to keep it short and simple, not get bogged down in too many what I call like really unnecessary details.
Fair enough.
Kind of the Reader's Digest version.
That's it. Sign me up. Good. But I always, whenever we stop like this, I always look back in the rearview mirror and make sure we didn't miss anything. Certainly of importance back there. Okay, well, with that, tell you what, let's wrap up this part one, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Ronnie Mack. Today is Thursday, July 14, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Ronnie, thank you so very, very much.
Well, you're very welcome.